addition to the bottom of it.
Thank you. I move the admission of Juliet Mitchell Durba, who is a member of the Bar of Good Standing in High School of Texas. I have knowledge of her credentials and am satisfied that she possesses the necessary qualifications. And I'd just like to say a personal note that Juliet's husband is named Matt, her only brother is named Jeffrey, and she has yellow labs. So ours was a match made in heaven. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have her with us for the past year. She's a smart, talented, and really charming young woman, and we wish her all the best. And we look forward to her continuing presence.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
If you would step to the clerk will administer the oath of office.
Please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that you will comport yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations and welcome to the Bar of the United States Court of Appeals.
Let's begin then with number 2008, E-Pass against Ecom et al.
Good morning. I am reserving 8 minutes since I have a number of responses I have to make to the appellees.
Well, you should be free to allocate your time as you'd like, but keep in mind that we do enforce the rule that no new arguments can be made on the button. So you can only respond to arguments made. So if you have something affirmative that you want to say, say it in your
opinion. I'd just like to say that this is not an exceptional case, as this court has typically found them in the past. And it's not an exceptional case because it's not a patent application that was prosecuted in bad faith and knowingly invalid. In fact, to this day, the patent is still valid. It's not a case that's unfamiliar to this court, as this is the third time it's been before the Federal Circuit. Prior time, there was a motion for summary judgment that this court affirmed. But prior to that, there was claim construction that this court ruled in our client's favor, having to do with the electronic multi-purpose card that was used for holding credit card information. This is not a case where attorney's fees should be awarded because the litigation misconduct is really not misconduct at all. It was really kind of the rough and tumble of general litigation which goes on, as at no time was E-Pass ever sanctioned by the magistrate judge or the district court judge. And in fact, there was a motion to hold the attorneys responsible for the attorney's fees, and the district court judge said, no, look, the activity, this rough and tumble stuff that goes on, did not rise to the level of sanctionable conduct.
What's the standard of review we have?
The standard of review is clearly erroneous with regards to whether or not the case is exceptional. It is perhaps a little bit lower when it comes to whether or not the district court apportioned the attorney's fees properly to the alleged misconduct, which is another point in our brief that we're arguing. So there are two issues before this court.
So you're suggesting here we go through, I mean, the district court went through excruciating detail and outlining the various conduct at the various stages in this litigation. We're supposed to say this is falls on the side of rough and tumble litigation versus the side of litigation misconduct. Is that what you're asking us to do?
No, I am not at all. But I am saying that it's a very dangerous thing to say litigation misconduct is a wand that you just wave over the entire proceeding and say because there were these instances of litigation misconduct, now all of the attorney's fees should be awarded. But rather, if there is litigation misconduct, then the attorney's fees that flow from that litigation misconduct should rightly be awarded perhaps during the proceedings, as opposed to trying to wait later on and say, well, the totality of all of this adds up to making the case exceptional, and therefore all the attorney's fees should be awarded. But I can see where if there was a finding that there was not a proper pre-filing investigation and that all of the fees that flowed from it, that's not this case. The court did say, well, maybe there's a dubious determination of maybe it wasn't done as well, but there was a pre-filing investigation. And on that basis, the court did not rely upon the fact that there was improper pre-filing investigation, but rather said that there was this litigation misconduct. And we believe that this is not the type of case where attorney's fees should be awarded. You know, the American rule that this court has supported is that the prevailing parties should pay their own attorney's fees. And here, this is a case where the plaintiff at all times in good faith, subjected to good faith, believed that there was an infringement. And at no time was it objectively basis. They had some arguments. They had some arguments that they prevailed before this court on with regards to the scope of the claims. And in the end, this court did find that, well, wait a second, maybe there wasn't any customer who was actually infringing, and so there couldn't be inducing infringement, and therefore that you lose. I understand that, and that's unfortunate, but that does not make this case objectively baseless, that there's not there's a basis to argue.
So, in your briefing, you rely heavily on the CES and the Visa in-house demonstrations to show some good faith basis to maintain this litigation. But those two things, or those two events, occurred, at least with respect to the Palm defendants, after the complaints were filed.
Yes, that is correct.
How would that provide a good faith basis for maintaining the litigation against the Palm defendants, the first filed suit?
If this were a case about whether or not there was an adequate pre-filing investigation, that's an excellent question, and nevertheless, a question needs to be responded to. And the point of this is, it's about the maintaining of the suit, which the court found would be a problem. And the fact that those exhibits occurred, and those demonstrations occurred, where you have basically the CEO of Palm standing up at the largest consumer electronics show and saying, this thing, this device made by Palm with the software, which of course Palm Source now access international controls with Visa, we're coming together and we're rolling this out. We're going to make this available across the country. This is the real McCoy. This is not a simulation. We're actually doing this.
But again, how does that relate to the suit that was filed a year before those demonstrations?
There was a belief because of the circumstantial evidence on counsel and a client that there was actually infringement going on, that they were in development. And surely they were in development. And of course, the proof is in the pudding that they did come out with a demonstration. They were going to roll out this combination of massive infringement that, if not stopped, obviously our client's rights to his intellectual property, the rights preclude others from doing something, would be eviscerated. And then, of course,
it occurs to me this is symptomatic of the problems that the district court seemed to have with this case throughout, and that is the sort of general gloss on all activities, all forms of conduct as being applicable to all different defendants relating to all different times without any attempt to sort of specify this defendant did this on this date and that raises a question of infringement, or that defendant did this on a different date, etc. There were general statements don't help elucidate exactly what's going on, and consistent with that, I noticed, for example, in your brief on page 25, at the top, you say, I'll give you a minute to find it. You say the district court even acknowledged that EPAS's pre-filing investigation did not make the case exceptional, citing the district court's opinion at Appendix 26. I can't find that.
If I read from page 26 of the district court's decision, it says, while EPAS's minimalist pre-filing investigation in and of itself may not make the case exceptional, when combined with the litigation's conduct, the case becomes one which is meritorious of the award of attorney's fees.
Yeah, that's in the context of the discussion with respect to Visa International.
Yes.
But that's not a statement made in the context of the other defendant defendants in the other suits, and it is not a statement that says, that acknowledges that EPAS's pre-filing investigation did not make the case exceptional.
Well, I have to interpret from the district court's decision that the district court did not say, with regards to the Palm defendants, you did not do an adequate pre-filing investigation. And so I'm assuming in the absence of that statement that the court, the district court did not find on that. It seems like the court primarily relied upon not a lack of pre-filing investigation, but really on this litigation misconduct, which had to do with things like, well, you're giving me the opportunity to take discovery, you didn't take discovery, gave me more time to get more evidence, you didn't do that, instead you moved across the motion for summary judgment. You didn't do certain things, and you kind of delayed the case, but again, it's...
Again, you're making sort of sweeping general statements. If you turn again to the district court's opinion at appendix page 840 and 841, the statement is set forth there. There is no evidence that any POM 7, Zier, Tungsten, or Trio have ever been used to practice the 311 method. This raises a serious question as to the adequacy of any pre-filing investigation by EPAS. How does that square with the statement you made in your brief?
It squares with my statement in brief in that with regards to one device versus the other device that was demonstrated at the show, that it could well be that there were certain devices that there was no evidence or information or pre-filing investigation on those devices. Perhaps those devices came out subsequent to the case was filed. I don't know particularly on that point. But it seemed to me when I read that decision and I read the point that the issue was not the lack of pre-filing investigation, because a lot of the Palm devices and Palm software as they came out were very different versions or upgrades of what was previously looked at as the part of the pre-filing investigation. I think counsel, including our appendix, submitted a declaration to the district court talking about what his pre-filing investigation was with regards to the Palm earlier device and the software that was in it.
What was your case against Visa USA?
The case against Visa USA was that Visa USA was in the process of rolling out a system where instead of having a credit card, you'd have all your credit cards, including the Visa credit card in your Palm device, and then you would basically select the Visa card and you put in your access code, and then you would transact business using this electronic multifunction card. And Visa was in the process, as they stated at the CES electronic show, kind of like a Steve Jobs would be standing at the Mac show saying, here's what we're rolling out, here's what we're doing.
And this is Visa USA?
This was Visa International.
I'm really trying to tease apart your case.
That is confusing to us, too, in a sense, because Visa International and Visa Inc., they share the same headquarters, they share the same counsel, they merged together, and now I'm not really sure what their status are, but they did notify the court that they were merged together, one and the same. And so whether or not Visa International and National people were at this trade show with the Visa USA people, I'm not sure if it's a distinction without a difference, if they're one company now because of the merger. So,
yeah, but whose fault is that? I mean, I think the district court concluded that you asked for extra time to conduct additional discovery with respect to the relationship, and you never took advantage of that opportunity. So, you're standing here now sort of explaining, well, we don't know what happened, but we'll be, who's responsible for that?
Well, I guess the question is there one entity? If they are one entity now, whether or not that is the next difference. And at the time, obviously, they were two separate entities, and the prior counsel did not take the discovery that was afforded, but instead was going to rely upon the fact that they were, in essence, highly related companies of one another. That's the arguments that were made.
Do you think that's appropriate? As litigation practice? I mean, well, that's not fair.
Well, if they're using the same counsel, they're all operating, it's a U.S. operation, it's a U.S. trade show, it's Visa USA, I understand, is the entity that runs the Visa operation in the U.S., and everything's occurring in the U.S., it seems to me not a great jump of leap to suggest that Visa USA is somehow involved, especially if it's the same facility and the same lawyers and the same everything else.
But why don't we reserve your rebuttal time and we'll hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Let's see, we have three different counsel who are going to argue.
We do, Your Honor.
All right. So each of you is taking 5 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who is first? Mr. Holland?
Actually, we're going to go in reverse order to the names printed on the
list. Mr. Sikorsky?
Yes, sir. See if that's all right with the court.
Yes, okay. Why don't you let us know who you represent? So we can get that straight.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Edward Sikorsky of DLA Piper, and I represent what the briefing calls, refers to the Palm defendants. Specifically, that would include Palm, Palm One, Recom, and Handspring. And to make it perhaps more easy, I do not represent either of the Visa entities, and my clients are not party to that particular lawsuit. And likewise, I do not represent Palm Source, which is now named Access Systems. Your Honors, obvious opposition to plaintiff counsel's suggestion, we do believe that this case was an exceptional case and it did warrant attorney's fees. As indicated earlier a few minutes ago, the court below, Senior Judge Jensen, did have serious questions about the pre-filing investigation against the Palm defendants in both sequentially the first filed case against Palm and the second filed case against Palm. Again, I'm not party to the Visa action. In addition to that serious question, as the court put it, the substance of Judge Jensen's order goes to the lack of discovery efforts by plaintiff's trial counsel and the meandering theories of litigation. So just to be clear on the record, it sounded as though plaintiff's counsel implied as though the CES and in-house Visa demonstrations employed similar software. Again, this is my assumption as to what he was getting at. Employed similar software to the allegations of infringement in the very first lawsuit in the year 2000, which again preceded both of those shows. I can assure you that the allegations in the first lawsuit, as reflected in plaintiff's first round of infringement contentions, which are found in the appendix beginning in chart form at A368, have nothing whatever to do with the software that, again, allegedly existed on any Palm device at the CES show.
Well, let me ask you a short clarification about that. As I recall, yours is the Palm 5, too.
Yes.
That device, there were no, the attorney's fees were not awarded.
Correct. Absolutely.
So what is the difference between that and the way we proceeded there versus the Palm 7 and the other devices?
If I understand the question correctly, the very first litigation was filed and was asserted only against Palm 7. And in the claim charts that are in that appendix citation, they refer to a website called PalmNet that facilitated some sort of interaction with a user. Again, the allegations died on the vine because soon after, after this court's first remand, a new round of infringement contentions came out, and by this time, all three suits had been filed. And that's when, again, by this time, we're post-CES and Visa in-house. At this point, plaintiff EPAS introduces claim charts alleging, in part, the CES show on the Palm 5. And the interesting side note on Palm 5 is that those claim charts were submitted to the parties a couple months after EPAS's counsel told the court, to Judge Jensen, that they would not assert any infringement allegations against the Palm 5. So that was, it's among the litany of issues that the judge had below. So the Palm 5 is again alleged to be the device used at the CES show. Again, I prefer not to talk about the Visa in-house because I'm not party to that lawsuit. So in that context, is where the thin citation, I believe, in Judge Jensen's order below, I think at 826, as Your Honor pointed out earlier, is where there's some mention of a pre-filing investigation. But again, that's not my lawsuit. I'm involved in just the other two. I hope that answers the question. In any event, the software, or more importantly, this certain website that was relied upon in the very first lawsuit, died on the vine, did not appear in the immediately subsequent round of infringement contentions against, again, all these Palm 7, Zyre, Tungsten, Trio devices. Instead, by this time, the infringement allegations had morphed to using these devices to access internet websites and do other kind of performances. Again, I should say, not relating anything whatsoever to the purported use by Mr. Yankowski of this Palm 5 device at CES. So it's important, I think, for the court to realize that there are three distinct lawsuits, and if you compartmentalize each one, the first lawsuit against Palm involved software completely unrelated to the CES show. That theory was abandoned in favor, subsequently, of a new theory involving some sort of website access. I'll leave it at that.
If you want to finish your thought, I think 5 minutes is plenty tight.
Yeah, I guess if I move any other thoughts that come from EPAS's counsel, their argument, I think that pretty much does it for.
Thank you. Now let's see. Jones is you up next. Again, if you would please tell us.
I represent Visa International and Visa USA. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel for Access has kindly asked if I would like an extra 2 minutes, and I said yes, so if I could take 2 minutes from his 5, that would be wonderful. EPAS made a couple of arguments that I'd like to address. First of all, its standard relies on the reasonably disputable language that comes from the Brooks case. The Brooks case says, so what it says is the case can't possibly be exceptional if infringement is reasonably disputable. However, in the Brooks case, there was no allegation of litigation misconduct. In fact, Brooks says, absent misconduct in litigation or in securing a patent, sanctions may be imposed against a patentee only if both the litigation is brought in subject to bad faith and the litigation is objectively baseless. That case is distinguishable because here the district court found litigation misconduct.
Can I assume along the same lines you wouldn't agree with the statement made about the citation to Serio in Gravey, I believe? There's a citation to Serio versus U.S. Industries, in which at least the citation says the standard for exceptional cases where the case was brought as objective bad faith and litigation is objective and baseless. And what's omitted is that portion of that sentence in Serio that says absence of misconduct.
Exactly. So the cases that EPAS relies on are Brooks, Diego, Serio US, and Forest Labs. And in three of those cases, the first three, there is that absent misconduct language which is omitted. So it's only the case that you look at, that you have to show both subjective bad faith and objective bad faith if there is no misconduct. Otherwise, the court looks at whether there is litigation misconduct, vexatious or unjustified litigation, inequitable conduct can be another example. And if it finds with clear and convincing evidence that any of those actions are in the case, it can find it an exceptional case. So the standard that EPAS is applying is a higher standard. This case is really more like the Nielsen case, which is a 2008 case. Exceptional case was based on three grounds: inequitable conduct, frivolous lawsuit, litigation misconduct, and the court did not use the bad, this court did not use the bad faith standard and affirmed a finding of exceptional case. It's also like the Beckman case. In the Beckman case, exceptional case was based on litigation strategy of vexatious conduct, and the district court here found that there was a litigation strategy of vexatious conduct. In that case, in the Beckman case, their exceptional case was affirmed. Again, the Beckman court did not use the bad faith standard and said that the district court is in the best position to judge litigation strategy. So here, the district court used the correct standard. It found clear and convincing evidence of litigation misconduct, and it found exceptional case. And this court should review those factual findings for clear error. There are numerous findings by the court separately with respect to Visa USA and Visa International as to litigation misconduct that started from the inception of the case. EPAS's counsel brought up this idea that Visa USA and Visa International are really the same. Well, throughout this case, they were separate entities, and we said that early on in the case. The district court allowed EPAS to do discovery on whether they were the same or different, whether there was any basis for vicarious liability. EPAS refused to take any of that discovery. And one of the reasons, I think, is that the basis of the suit alleged in the complaint was the two demonstrations, the CES demonstration and also the in-house demonstration at Visa International. And then there was some other ongoing conduct that was alleged that wasn't specified. And Rule 11b3 was specifically referenced to say that in discovery we'll find out what that conduct is. Early on in the case, and really before this case even started, in the deposition of Susan Gordon Lathrop, a Visa International Vice President, in 2001, with respect to the Palm case, her deposition was taken. And there was evidence in her testimony in her deposition that these demos were proof of concept, that Visa International or Visa USA was not involved, that only Visa International was involved.
Now, you represent both entities.
I actually represent both entities.
Were they separately represented in trial?
No, they were represented by Townsend. Both entities were represented by Townsend.
How would the addition of Visa USA have increased the fees under those circumstances materially?
Visa USA and Visa International were both named in the complaint. Visa USA did not participate in the demonstrations at all, didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
And we filed a motion to dismiss to say Visa USA doesn't belong in the suit, separate entity. Visa USA was kept in the suit, and we were never sure what the allegations were as to Visa USA. If the basis of the case was the two demos, Visa USA didn't participate at all. If the basis of the suit is the ongoing conduct, unspecified, never clear what that was, we don't know why. So Visa had to participate throughout the case trying to figure out, why are we in this case? Why aren't we dismissed as a separate entity? And so the fees were not just with respect to the demos, but also this unspecified conduct. And what happened was that EPAS would shift its theory. Sometimes it would even shift its theory between the motion and the hearing. So it would say, oh, the basis of the case is really the demos. But when that wasn't going anywhere, it would switch and say, oh, no, it's really this unspecified conduct. And if we could only have more discovery, we'd be able to tell you what that is.
It seems odd, just to sort of piggyback on Jeff Price's question, is that, as I understand it, the fees assessed and the costs assessed with respect to Visa USA and Visa International are exactly the same, down to the penny.
Right.
It seems like, based on what you've expressed and what the record reveals, the litigation and the arguments and what's done with respect to the two entities would have been somewhat different.
They were different in the sense that, with respect, and we always argued separately, motions were filed separately, with respect to USA and the demos, USA wasn't involved. With respect to Visa International, for example, well, Visa International was there, but the steps weren't performed. It wasn't on an electronic multifunction card, etc. Steps weren't performed in the correct order, etc. So the arguments were different, but both entities had to participate in three rounds of summary judgment motions, motion to dismiss, motions to compel. And with respect to the summary judgment motions, many times we were trying to figure out, well, what is EPAS really arguing here? If they're arguing this, this is our response. If they're arguing this, this is our response. And as the district court also said, EPAS made no evidentiary submissions in its last or any of its summary judgment motions. So the court was left to analyze for itself whether there was infringement and found that there wasn't.
Very well. Why don't we hear next, I guess, it's from Mr. Oliver. Thank you, Ms. Jones.
I'm Andrew Oliver, representing the company known as Access Systems Americas, which in most of the court's decisions, I think all of them, was known as Palm Source at the time. I think the court has already hit upon the issues that I want to make sure are absolutely clear, that this is a separate company, there were separate cases. In the case in which Access Palm Source was involved, three devices were accused of infringement. And those were devices manufactured by Palm One, one of the other defendants, for which Palm Source supplied software. And in that case, as referenced in this court's prior decision at 473 F3rd at 1217, there were three devices called Tungsten, Zyre, and Trio, were the handheld devices that were at issue. Palm Source was accused not of making those devices or inducing infringement with respect to them, but just of supplying software and unspecified promotional and instructional materials that were somehow related to those devices. And the reason that this is important is that the EPAS has inferred that the litigation misconduct was the basis for all the fees in these cases. With respect to Palm Source, the court awarded Palm Source virtually all of the fees from the inception of the litigation. The court cut out certain categories, and there were certain categories that we didn't request to be reimbursed for. But I note that that the court made what appears to us to be very explicit findings that there was no pre-filing investigation with respect to Palm Source. And at page 844, starting at line 1, the court notes, given the opportunity to present as evidence, EPAS has identified no direct evidence that the 311 method has ever been practiced on a Palm 7, and it gets to a Zyre, a Tungsten, or a Trio, the three devices at issue in the case where Palm Source was a party, and goes on to state the non-existence of any direct infringement evidence to be presented at the time of summary judgment leads inexorably to the conclusion that there was no such evidence known to the plaintiff at the time these cases were filed. And for making that point, I just want to make sure it's absolutely clear this is a separate defendant, and there was what we think is a very explicit finding of no pre-filing investigation, and EPAS has not challenged that finding as being as a clear error or made any factual challenges with respect to that.
Now, I believe, is that all you have?
That's all I heard.
Now, you have, I think it's your client's filed a motion for Rule 38 fees.
Yes.
The motion now. We have the motion. I think we have not received a response yet to that motion that was filed fairly recently.
Right.
Very well.
I had hoped to file it in advance so we could address it at the hearing if the court wanted to, but our client wanted to give as long as possible to see if EPAS decided to withdraw the appeal as to access. And unfortunately, I believe I waited one day too long, and it was a mistake in timing on my part. And
oh, that's fine. We will await response. We be unlikely to rule on the motion without taking a full case in your submission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sislow has indicated we do have the motion, I'm sure you have it as well, and that we would invite response.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the response is due on the
12th. It's not yet. Yeah, that's right.
And we did not have a pre-filing meeting on that because I was on vacation, and I guess they delayed whatever the circumstances.
I think if you would try to test it on a timely basis, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Of course. The one of the issues I'd like to address, if I might, is that a couple things. We are contending that the conduct alleged does not rise to the level of litigation misconduct. It might be bad lawyering to shift the theory or to make one argument and then change your mind and make another argument, but it is not litigation misconduct. And throughout these proceedings, Judge Jensen, at least with the POM products, did not award attorney's fees in front of the filing of the complaint, but only after the Federal Circuit made a determination that, with regards to claim construction, I think the judge decided that perhaps EPAC should have called it a day when they couldn't find the direct infringer, other than that what was viewed as now a simulation test that the Consumer Electronics Show, as opposed to the real McCoy, is advocating. And so, with regards to those POM devices, clearly the court felt that there was an adequate pre-filing investigation. Also, the lack of taking discovery when given opportunity to do so, again, is not litigation misconduct. It is, again, probably bad lawyering. But in context, there were 15 motions for summary judgment that this lawyer was trying to respond to, and it also had the opportunity to take discovery, my recollection of the record.
But when you file motions to compel depositions and then get them ruled on and then never go forward with the depositions?
Again, I think that would probably be bad lawyering, but I don't think it's litigation misconduct. The fact that you don't get the evidence that now you have a right to get, I don't know any cases that say that is litigation misconduct. But again, I believe it's probably bad lawyering. Why did that happen? I don't know why that happened. But again, with regards to...
Well, I think the take, as I don't know whether this is reading the lines or perhaps a bit between the lines, but what I understood the district court's take on that was that this was part of an effort to keep the case alive by whatever means necessary without really having a good faith intention to follow up on the means cited to keep the case alive. So that if that's the right way to view what was going on, then it isn't simply a case of bad lawyering and failing to follow up on opportunities to get evidence that was likely available, but rather a ploy simply to avoid having a dispositive order entered against the plaintiff.
But Judge Jensen didn't find that any of these attorney conduct constituted sanctionable conduct. The district court specifically said that look, these attorneys really didn't do anything wrong that would justify an award of attorney's fees against them. So it's kind of a contradiction here. If these are all things that attorneys are doing and they have the control over, apart from the client, because these are all tactical or decision, take a deposition, not take a deposition, get the discovery or not, it seems to me that if this were really an exceptional case, these lawyers who made all these tactical decisions would have been found to be liable as well. But they were not, because the district court made a specific finding that he did not believe that this conduct was the type of conduct that would be actionable that would allow the award of attorney's fees. And on that point, it seems to us that, again, we're not saying that this is a great lawyer, it's a terrible lawyer, but again, it's not the litigation misconduct that we're talking about. where people are sanctioned and they violate court orders and held accountable for those court orders. Instead, we have a proceeding that lasted over a period of time that, you know, EPAS did prevail before this court on one occasion, and the case was alive, but then there was a change in the evidence when Susan Lathrop said, oh no, that demonstration you did in Las Vegas, that was really all a charade. It really wasn't real. It was only a proof of concept, despite what they said, because the language is pretty clear. It makes pretty clear that they were going to roll this thing out, and our client should have had kind of the right to be able to stop that kind of imminent infringement. And so it appears that all of these parties were working together to try to make these products work as a credit card machine. We have a bunch of credit cards, and the Palm Source people, the Palm people, and Visa, that I think there's no doubt that they were all working to bring this about. But the reality of it is, I don't know why it's not in existence. I don't know if it's a bad business concept. For whatever reason, it never rolled out. But I believe that EPAS had a good faith belief of going forward and trying to stop that, especially as the evidence the record shows, they're trying to negotiate this very profitable deal with Microsoft. So if that system would have rolled out and infringing that patent, then it would have been catastrophic for EPAS, which had the patent, which is really a right to exclude others. So the question is, should they have waited a little bit longer, waited till these things did roll out and then file suit? But that would have been too late. So they did file suit when they did to stop.
Why would it have been too late? Certainly, if there was infringement, the accused infringers would have achieved any non-vested rights by virtue of...
I understand that. But from a business standpoint, most businesses want to make something and license it and so forth. They don't want a lawsuit. Yeah, there are people out there that just want to sue people and get money for it. But if you look at EPAS, the intent of EPAS was to have a viable business that they'd be able to launch or license the Visa and people at Microsoft. That was the whole idea. The whole idea of throwing that business model out to the side. Now all you have is the right to bring a lawsuit and try to collect damages against somebody. Most business people don't like that kind of business. They're not designed for that. And so in this particular case, they made decisions. The lawyers made decisions. Well, probably tactically they were false. They lost the case. And so that's unfortunately the consequence that both the client and the lawyers bear. But it is not the type of litigation misconduct or bad faith that this court typically will look at and sustain attorney's fees for in a situation like that. And with that, I thank you for your time and hope that you will find that the case is not exceptional.
Thank you. And you will provide us with a response to the
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.